Welcome to the Mug Meetings Summaries Podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our November meeting's main topic was migrating to IPv6 and featured Mark Jenkins presenting some of the basic theory and showing how to do static configuration on a GNU Linux system.
All right, well, for starts, I never actually went on the diet. That was the intention. I never got around to it. Part of the thing I was thinking of when I wanted to do that was, oh, you know what? All my favorite news sites are not on IPv6, so maybe I'll have more time on my hands. Turns out, it would have been easy to cheat. My tunnel broker has this thing where you can put in, like, www.mug.mb.ca.6xs.org, and you, boom, they automatically tunnel you to whatever IPv4-only site. So I could have seen all my news sites anyways, even if I had gone on my diet. My second plan was, okay, well, I'm going to put you guys on an IPv6-only diet for the night, and even that's fallen through. I'm actually using a little Guru plug, a little plug computer as a router, and I've got an access point. And it's successfully handing out global addresses here, but my upstream tunnel is getting filtered by IBM. But IBM is letting SSH out, so if I'd really prepped, I could have built a tunnel to my office that way and then tunnel to my IPv6 tunnel provider. And things would have worked out peachy, but too bad. You're gonna get an address from me, and it's not gonna take you anywhere. So, sorry. This is a new logo for my company. Does anyone see the gimmick with the trick in it?
Oh yeah.
Adam sees it. Tell him.
I was wondering why it was there at first. I didn't figure it out.
So what's the gimmick in the logo?
Equal sign.
Yeah, equal sign in parody. Okay. And I think many of you have seen my presentations before, but I'm just going to do the sort of my quick mug background. First mug meeting I ever went to was September 11, 2001. It was second Tuesday in September, and it was awesome that mug didn't shut down the meeting, and even though it was in a tall building, it all went on. I was just getting into Unix stuff at the time. I had a little 46 I bought on eBay. And it came time for questions, and I had a question that I didn't ask. It was a little embarrassing. The question was, how do I get out of VI? So that was my first mug experience. All right, so copyright's a strange beast, because there's a copyright on the slides, there's a copyright on the performance, and there's a copyright in any recordings or photos anyone makes. So for the part that's me, the slides, and my performance, share it. There's my license. Okay, so the network here, I'll show how I joined onto it with Gilbert's laptop. Gilbert's using Network Manager. And at first I wasn't able to connect to to this network, IPv6 only. What I had to do originally, this was checked off, require IPv6 addresses for this connection to complete. So by default, Network Manager doesn't like a network that is IPv6 only. It insists on getting at least an IPv4 address, but it does come by default to also configure itself to get a v6 address. So all I had to do was uncheck this, and I had to wait for it still trying to get a v4 address. But if I could have also done disabled here, and it would have been faster. I had the same issue on my laptop, which is using Network Manager as well on Debian. Okay, so, and if anyone else is joining this network, you might find out about the name servers I'm advertising, though you cannot reach them because my router isn't able to tunnel to my tunnel broker. A lot of people probably might have gotten a global address from my router, My router would have said to you, hey, here's the subnet. Construct an address on this global IPv6 subnet using partially your Ethernet address to help form your public IPv6 address. So I was using stateless address auto configuration on the LAN I brought here, meaning that there's nothing stored on my router. All it does is advertise that, hey, I'm the router, you can route through me, and yeah, this is the network you can be part of and self-assign yourself a public IPv6 address on. And the DNS stuff I wasn't doing with DHCP v6 either. It was also this this newer thing that only became a standard in 2010. So Gilbert's laptop picked it up, and oh, I didn't even check that. Yeah, let's see. Did we get the name servers that are not reachable? Yeah, we did. Okay. And these name servers that are provided by my tunnel broker, you can get some IPv6 addresses through them that you couldn't get through through say your ISP's DNS server or doing your own queries. And that's because some places are not letting their IPv6 addresses be known unless they trust that you've got a decent IPv6 deployment, because they don't want you trying to reach them on crappy IPv6. And so the thing that happened on IPv6 test day in June was that all of the big players who do that normally, they stopped doing that. And I tested it myself that day. I queried my provider's caching servers, and I did some direct queries of my own. And, you know, Google and Facebook and everybody, they were actually giving out their IPv6 addresses, you know, regardless of where you queried them from. Most of the time, that's not true. The big players are kind of afraid. So, but these named servers that are provided by my tunnel broker, you can actually get, like, the google.ca, google.com IPv6 records through them. So if I had Upstream here, I would actually hit up Google with this and say, look, one of the... And it's a barren... It is really barren out there. If I had actually gone on an IPv6 diet, and if that sort of convenient service for looking at IPv4 sites hadn't existed, you know, I wouldn't have been looking at anything. I would... it would have been a success in keeping me off news sites if that wasn't true. And so maybe all I have to do is block that service, and I'm good. And I can, just use V6 to get between my different hosts someday. Okay, so some of you might have gotten that name server, picked up that name server with that newer RFC there that was only officially adopted a year ago and came out as an experimental in 2007. I think for a lot of people, auto-configuration with DHCP V6 works a lot better, but this stateless stuff was a little more more bleeding edge and a little more in the style of IPv6. Like, hey, there's so many bits that you can self-assign yourself a global address if you know your prefix. Okay, so I keep talking about prefixes, and I'm going to give you guys the really basic networking lesson, but I'm not going to give the lesson with the 32-bit IPv4 or the 128-bit IPv6. Let's just do some, so we can understand some V6 stuff later, let's do a really basic lesson in networking in the 8-bit net. And it's really too bad the color didn't work out here. I don't know if anyone can see it.
Barely.
But... Yeah. I've colored some of the numbers. I'm just going to have to point it out manually because it's not quite nothing. Oh, we're going to give it a try.
Laser pointer. Yep.
Yep. Oh, we're just going to use the pointer.
Okay.
Oh,
the
trigger. Okay. So, welcome to the 8-bit net. There's three really big networks on my 8-bit net. There's the land of Oz, there's the land of punk, and there's the land of classics. And... in the land of Oz, there's a sub-network, the Witch's House, and as an example, one host that's on the Witch's House is the Cauldron. I'm going to get back to all these numbers in a moment. And same for classics, there's a sub-network in the classics network that's Shakespeare. Okay. So what the /3 means is that these three... most significant bits are what are constant for the Oz network. So all the addresses on the Oz network start with 010, and then it's the other five bits, the five least significant bits that are different. So you could say that it actually starts at 00000, but that address is reserved for just describing the network. So the first actual host on the Oz network would be 00. These three that are always the same, and then 0001, one above that. And then same for the very last host on Oz, it's still got the same 3-bit prefix, 010, and the rest is all ones except the last one, because if it was all ones, that's what's reserved for broadcast. So there's five bits that... there's 3 bits that are constant in Oz's network. There's 5 bits that vary. So there's sort of 2 to the 5 possible addresses in Oz's network board. 32. And so a similar thing with the classics and the punk. The first, the /3 means these three bits are constant. It's the other bits that the different hosts on that subnetwork have that vary. So the Witch network is a subnetwork of the Land of Oz network. And so what we say is it's a /5. So the first three are inherited from Oz because Witch is a subnetwork of Oz. But then it's actually all the most 5 significant digits are what are constant for the Witch's network. So this is the lowest address. This is the highest address. Either way, these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 binary digits are always the same. And also the 1, 2, 3 from the Oz network. So you can see that back on the original here as well. 1, 2, 3 digits that are the same for Oz. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 that are different. Those are colored red on my original slide. It would have been a lot more readable. I got color right. Witch's house. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bits are always the same. And what varies on that network are the 1, 2, 3 least significant digits. So that's 2 to the 3, 8 hosts the witch has. And a similar thing with Shakespeare on classics. So then you can say, okay, what do the routing tables look like on the 8-bit net? And hopefully I go back and forth here. So I'm imagining there's two different kinds of routing table entries. There's the ones that say link, meaning the thing described in the, there's always a destination. You're saying, how do I get to such and such place? And then on the right-hand side here, we're saying, well, that you just have to use a direct link that you have to them and you'll reach them. Or for a particular destination, we might say, if you want to reach that destination, you've got to go through somebody else's gateway. So look at this example first. 101.001. Oz, so if Oz wants to reach Punk, it's a direct, direct link to Punk's router, and so that's all we were saying with the first one. If someone on Oz wants to reach anything on the Punk network, so these three bits remaining the same. And these three, the remaining 5 bits being varying, then we go, this is the same address as here. And so I'm using the /8 on this one to say that to describe that all of these bits are what we're, none of them vary. We're saying it's exactly all 8 bits that describe this link. I think I could go on and on that, but I think I'm putting people to sleep. I'll be posting this, so it's homework. Okay. So, but yeah, basically, Oz has an entry saying how to reach Punk's network. How to reach Punk's router, how to reach Punk's network via Punk's router. Same for classics. And its routing table doesn't actually have to say specifically, well, how do I reach Shakespeare? Because Shakespeare is a subnetwork of classics. Shakespeare shares these first 3 bits as a prefix, classics. All Oz's routing table says is, well, how do I get to classics router? Oh, I just use the direct link. And, okay, how do I get to everything else on classics? I do that via classics router. So there doesn't need to be any entry in here saying anything about this subnetwork. And this stuff here. Okay, so the witch's house has an even simpler routing table because it's connected to less things. Basically, okay, how do I get back to the Oz router? And here's my own local area network. And if I want to get anywhere else on the 8-bit net, so here we're using /0 to saying, well, you know what, all of these bits can vary. They could be 1s or 0s, I don't know. Go through Oz's router. Anyways, this is hard to follow. You guys can find this on the website. Simplest entry is the simplest routing table is on the cauldron. Because the cauldron's only got two things it needs to know. It just needs to know that it's on the witch's house's local area network. And it needs to know that if it wants to get to the rest of the 8-bit net, it just needs to go through the witch house router. All right, you guys will be glad this is posted and that I'm not spending any more time on this. Instead, I'll hit you with hexadecimal instead because we're going to go to IPv6 soon, and good to refresh your memory. So the idea of hexadecimal is you represent, instead of using 10 distinct symbols, 0 through 9, to represent numbers, you can use 16 distinct symbols. So 0 through 9, 10 symbols, and A, B, C, D, E, F to give you 6 more symbols. And then the way you count it is, you know, A is 10. If you're writing A in hexadecimal, that's 10. B is 11, C is 12, B is 13, E is 14, F is 15. So going beyond that, then you're starting your next place value again. So 10 in hexadecimal is 16. That's what follows F. So blah, 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 you keep counting it. 10, 11, 11, 19. What follows 19 is 1A, 1B, 1C. Okay, so counting goes for on, you know, I count with dot, dot, dots all the way up to FF there, which would be 255. So every time you see a hex digit, there's a nickname for it. People call it a nibble. Bite on that. And if we know that there's 16 hexadecimal digits can represent 16 different values. What is that equivalent to in binary? Or the way to ask it is, how many bits would it take to represent 16 different values? Or 2 to the what is equal to 16? So the answer to that is 4. So every time you're seeing a hex nibble, it's actually 4 binary digits. So just these here allow you to count from 000 all the way up to 111 in binary. So 2 hex nibbles, or 2 times 4 bits, is 8 bits. And remember this, 4 hex nibbles is 16 bits. That's a grouping that we're going to see in IPv6 in a second. And then here's how we get to IPv6 being 128 bits, you can look at it as being 8 sets of these 16 bits, or 4 hex nibbles. So 8 times 16, 128. So there's the ridiculous arithmetic that gets you using hex all the way up to 128 bits. If we represented IPv6 addresses using decimal, they would be a lot longer, because you only have 10 symbols. When you have 16 symbols, you can condense it a lot more, but you get to do a lot more than that. So this is the address of my router. This is an IPv6 address. So the convention on IPv6 addresses is that you write 16 bits at a time, and then there's 8 sets of those. 8 times 16 and 28. But that can be pretty long. This is the longhand version of the router that I'm running here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's a lot of 16-bit sets of 4 nibbles. So it turns out there, for most IPv6 addresses, there's a convenient way to compress them down, as I've done above here. So if we look at this third set of 16 bits, it's 021B. And so the way you compress it is, if you have between the colons, if you say write 2 digits or 1 digit or 3 digits, it's assumed that there's some most significant hex digits that are zeros that are being left out. So this is equivalent to this. And this case, this one here, is an even more extreme case. It's only one nibble is being printed, but there's actually 3 more significant nibbles that would be in front of it. So you can abbreviate 0002 with just 2. And here we've got continuous zeros all the way up until the end, so we can actually abbreviate that with a double colon. And lucky us, this address fits in a lot less space. That works well for static addresses. When automatically assigned addresses will always take up more space. I'll actually just show Gilbert's. It's a good example. Okay, so the global address, in quotes, because it's not really reachable, that Gilbert got from my router is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, they all ended up printed there. But yeah, not too inconvenient because it was automatically assigned anyways. The really cool thing is you'll notice that Ethernet addresses, which are 48 bits, it actually uses that to assign the unique part here. So 0909, 0E, it's taking advantage of the 0 could be pulled out there, same abbreviation, FF. And then this FF and this FE are like filler to help fill it up. And then we're back on track. FA, F9, and...
YBB instead of 8-8.
Yeah, must be part of whatever the rules are. Couldn't tell you.
They flip a bit.
Ah, they're flipping. All right. this is too bad. I also had color separating out the bits that stay the same and the bits that actually change as well, but
you can sort of see it.
Yeah, you'll see it on the posted version. Anyway, so what my tunnel broker has assigned to me, aside from the two addresses used for the tunnel, they've routed they've given me an entire subnet. I had to ask for it, but I didn't have to do that much. Of a /48, so 1, 2, 3 sets of 16, 3 times 16. So these are the bits that do not change, and it's, see the double colon here, it's all the rest are up to me to assign however I want. And yeah, oh, and here it is written out in full. Forget about you've ever heard about 2 to the power of 128 IPv6 addresses and how you can cope the universe with them. It's never going to come to that because the talk is of giving like every... sort of everyone who buys an internet connection, every home, every business, the talk is to give them maybe everybody a /48. So if we gave everyone /48 and we just did that straight up without having bigger allocations, which there are, but let's imagine we just gave everyone a /48 like I had. Hundreds, thousands, millions, billions, only trillions, okay? So it's actually a somewhat graspable number. And of course there'll be a lot more of them than that because there's all kinds of providers with much much bigger chunks than /48. Alright, but let's say you're given a /48, what are you going to do with it? If you wanted to divide it up, the suggestion is every time you have like a local area Ethernet LAN or wireless LAN like we're running here, that you should actually waste 64 of the bits and let you have your entire LAN be assigned 46 bits that actually vary. So that's what this router is advertising as well. And that provides, and actually all these rules for auto assignment of addresses like assume that. You know, with 48 bits in the IPv in an Ethernet address, you know, it's not too many more bits to get up to use up the whole 64 with the padding we saw. So this is sort of what's being suggested as the minimum network. So this is the one we're running here. And so how many of these do I have because of my /48 allocation? I've got, way to do the math is it's 64 minus 48 is 16, 2 to the 16. So I could have 65,000 networks like the one I'm running here. And the idea is everyone on this network has this prefix of 64 bits, and the remaining 64 bits are what vary.
Yes.
Okay. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think IPv6 will herald the end of The other way of describing subnetworks. So this format where you use a slash, whether it's on the 8-bit net that I made up, or the 32-bit IPv4, or the 128-bit IPv6, the more modern way to write them is with this slash style, where the number after the slash is the number of bits that are unchanging on that network, and it's the other ones that vary. But in IPv4, there was also this old way of saying, yeah, 24 of the bits are constant, and the other 8 bits are moving. And I think it was pretty graspable when it was just like this, you know, like 192.168.0, oh, okay, that's my mask. So that means, okay, 192 stays the same, 168 stays the same, the O stays the same, and we just start counting on the last 8 bits. Okay, 1, 2, 3, blah. Okay, but how do you calculate this, right? This takes a little more time. So what's a slash 29? I've got one at home from my provider. And so, okay, we look at it, the sets of 4 sets of 8 bits. Okay, so 4 plus 4 is 8. 8 plus 8 is 16. Plus 8 is 24. Okay, 20. But I've got 29. I got 29 bits that are constant. So that means in the last 8, there are 5 that I also cannot change that do not belong to me. So the final 8 bits in a slash 20. You know, the first 24 bits are all ones. In a slash 29 mask, but then there's also 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more. Okay, so I cannot convert this in my head, and it's only because I've done things on my slash 29 enough times that I actually remember this 248. Otherwise, I'd actually have to write it out in binary like this and convert it, or use a tool like ipcalc. Okay, so slash 29 is 255.255.255.248, or 29 ones. Is all they're trying to say by this. Okay, and I've been assigned 208.81.1 that's in 2 slash that. Okay, so what is, if I'm wondering, what is the remaining 8 bits of my network look like? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's, and then 000, that's 72 in binary. So I've got 3 bits to play with at home. I've got basically 6 real addresses. So yeah, 23. All right, so hopefully dotted decimal is gone and someone doesn't find some ugly hexadecimal way to do it with IPv6 and make it popular. Or maybe they already have. I don't know. Okay. So I can't demo every Unix out there. Gilbert, I actually need root, if you don't mind. Okay. You guys are going to have to trust me on this first one, but basically if you bring your link up and you've got IPv6 support on Linux, and if there's a router like mine that's actually advertising prefixes, you'll get a global address assigned to you right away, just by bringing your link up, because you'll get a link local address, and if a router is advertising a chance for it, you'll self-assign yourself a global address based on the assigned networks. But let's say you want to do a static address instead. So we'll do that. IP. And this IP command is from like the IP route to suite of tools, which is supposed to supersede the sort of old ifconf way of doing things. Okay, add. I'm going to use this a bit here. So yeah, these addresses are a bit ugly to type, but there's always copy paste, right? They've already lost a lot of time there. I got some shots. Dev WN0. Okay. And so okay, this is cool. IFconfig ends up showing this is the global address that I was sort of auto-assigned. With the help of a network manager, is the link local address. And, I screwed that one up.
Because I didn't put the slash 64 in there. Okay, so let's do this. I got to delete the old one.
You have to withdraw the old version.
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, so if anyone is on the LAN, you can ping Gilbert through that address now, which is a lot easier to pick up than that one. Ping 6 might be the name of the command.
All right, let's move on. That's a way to do static assignment. And routing, adding a route entry here, I'm doing it the old-fashioned way where I use the old route command. But this newer thing, IP, that is like part of the IP route tool, suite of tools, could have done this as well. Anyway, so if I'd never joined, if this network, say, didn't even have auto-discovery, this is how I would have gotten on it. I would have added that address, and I would have said, okay, the little guru plug router there is this gateway, and I'm using it as my default. This is ugly. Look at all the entries. Ooh, man. All my IPv6 route table entries. But the most basic one is here. That one's saying this is the one describing the network I've put together here. And
what does the IP route output look like for IPv6?
I'm sorry?
What does IP route output look like for IPv6?
Oh, I don't know. That's not even completing.
IP space route.
Oh, I see. You gotta give it something.
IP6 space route?
There's lots of stuff here.
List.
Of course.
All right.
Or not.
Well, that sucks.
Never mind.
Okay, never mind.
Let's save that for another day. Someone wants to go home, I'm sure. Here's how you do a static config in Debian-based systems and Debian derivatives. So the only thing that changes is instead of inet here is you're trying to put inet6. So there's me assigning that same address at mask gateway. And if I'd gotten rid of these last three lines and I'd said IFACE E0 inet6 manual, it would have done the same thing that bringing the link up would have done. It would have, if there's a router here saying, hey, you can get a global address, it would have get one with like a two-liner like that too. This is just part of the syntax in Debian FC network interfaces. So you have an auto and interface name followed by interface name if you want that interface to come up on boot and be configured on boot. If you want to bring it up and down manually, you would not include the auto part. And that only really only affects on boot. Once you've booted, you can do IF down, E0, IF up, E0, whether you have auto there or not. Okay, let's move on. So how to get everyone on IPv6. Here's my very oversimplified transition plan and my very oversimplified view of the internet. The ideal way to think of the internet and the reason we all want to be excited about IPv6 is end-to-end connectivity. Anybody can connect to anyone. The social reality, as I see it, is that most people aren't doing end-to-end communications. Most of the relationships out there on the internet are there's people who consume internet services. They're trying to consume them from companies that provide services over the internet, Google, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And tying them all together are telecommunication companies that do networking. So that's a very simple way to view the world. And so what are telecoms going to offer people? Right now they're offering actually both the first two options. Some telecoms are now not even giving you real IPv4 addresses. They are giving you private IPv4 addresses
and then doing network address translation to, you know, shared with real IPv4 addresses. And sadly, this may become pretty common. But it costs these guys because their equipment's got to do a little more work to do that mapping. And, you know what they say, like, you know, 80% of your problems come from 20% of your places. You know, it's going to break things for that 20% of customers who are doing things that end-to-end where network address translation really sucks. So the hope is that they're going to offer this someday. But why are the telecoms going to offer people IPv6 access if none of their customers want it, right? We have a bit of a dependency loop in making a transition to IPv6. And the way out of it, I don't think, is to dual stack everyone. I think that's going to be messy as hell. Maybe it'll go that way anyway. My hope is that the squares, the people who provide internet services, the Googles and Facebooks and, you know, www.mug.nv.ca's of the world, are that they go dual stack. And they can do that if they're not a lot of people are reaching them through IPv6, they don't need their telecoms to provide to them. They can use tunneling services. So here's where I have to take the leap of faith. There's no obvious reason why that's going to benefit them in the short term to put that investment in. But at the same time, it doesn't cost them a lot. And so I'm hoping at some point, the hopeful sort of naive part here is that these people are going to say, you know, it doesn't cost us that much to go dual stack, and the future of the internet kind of depends on it. Let's make ourselves reachable to people who are IPv6 only. What that hopefully does is, for a lot of these people, some of them might spend 99% of their time on the top 100 websites. And if, as soon as the service providers are accessible by v6, then it starts to make sense to offer this to end consumers, because this is costly, this is costly, this is cheap. And so what I hope someday the pitch will be for telecoms who do offer IPv6 to their customers is, hey, you're not browsing much of the, you're using a small number of internet services, they've all gone, and, you know, the top 100 and some of the long tail have gone dual stack, save some money every month, go on this. And then hopefully there's a snowball effect where we get all of the people providing services to go dual stack, because there'll be some end users who opt not to access the whole internet who are happy if they get just the top 100 and the long tail. So that's my naive hope and theory of how it goes, because it means we only need to dual stack. We only need to dual stack these guys initially. So it's cheap and easy to do. If by connecting to a tunnel broker. So if you're running a service that people connect to and visit, this is how you can help. Make yourself dual stack, and if enough, we got to remember these guys are a small chunk of the internet as well. You know, most of the addresses are handed out to these folks. People who just consume, or addresses that are in use, I should say. There's a lot of wasted chunks as well, of course. I really think it only takes enough critical mass of the most popular service providers being dual stack that the $5 a month that it would save some of these people, that some of these people say, well, all I do is Facebook and Twitter anyway. Okay, I'll save $5 a month, and then hopefully things snowball from there. I know, it's naive. Okay, so here's this is the configuration on my router, the little guru plug there, for how with the route advertisement daemon. And this is a really basic one. So on F0, it's saying, okay, this is it'll advertise that this network is available. And that's one of the name servers that my tunnel broker provides. This protocol isn't as widely supported. But it also, because this advertisement actually comes from this router, I don't even have to write in the address of the router that because I make that advertisement, it gets figured out. Or the daemon figures it out. I'm not sure. Okay, reverse DNS is kind of ugly in IPv6. So the nature of DNS as a whole is that the most significant parts are on the right, the least significant parts on the left. So www.google.com. the root of the domain name system, is the most significant part. .com is the next significant part. Google, so on, right? That's the level of delegation. But the way we write our IPv4 and IPv6 addresses is we write the most significant stuff on the left, the most significant bits on the left, and the least significant bits on the right. So reverse DNS, whether it's IPv4 or IPv6, always looks a bit strange, because here's the question. I'm looking, okay, what is the reverse of this IPv6 address? And so you can see it's 2001.49, right? It's all written out backwards, because the way DNS is written out is most significant to least significant. So there's my query, and I get a host name back. So okay, that's crazy to read. But no, what's even crazier is configuring your DNS server to be responsible for answering your reverse stuff. So in the case of my tunneling provider, they actually let me delegate for my whole /48. I actually tell them, yeah, my name server is responsible for answering the reverse queries about that entire /48. So, okay, this isn't so bad. This is my /48 written backwards in bind here. But here's where things get hideous. Okay, so here's my blah, blah, blah .db file. This is implicit here. This is what was said in effect here in the zone statement, that okay, I'm responsible for everything below that. But yeah, here's me writing out the entire /64 one at a time, all the way from that. So those are, it's a lot of copy pasting, and there's nothing I hate more than copy pasting, because redundancy is, you know, the root of all evil, right? What happens when my prefix changes, you know, and then I got to start playing with set and stuff and not screw that up.
How does mine differentiate between IPv4 and 6 addresses?
Oh, okay, well, actually, for reverse entries, not at all, because all the kind of records I'm creating are PTR records for reverse DNS. So this works.
Reverse DNS decimals for in 4?
All of DNS is decimal notation.
But this is not decimal, or is this decimal?
Those are
hexadecimal.
It's hex. Oh, you're talking about the letters.
Subdomain is a hex digit.
No, bind doesn't care.
Actually, well, bind is just looking at a character string, really.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. All bind is really sensitive is to all the dots.
Yeah. It's a character string, right? Really. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when they come out with IPv7, I suspect bind is ready. So there's a lot of redundancy in here. I can't stand it. So the origin keyword in bind comes to the rescue. So first of all, I say, okay, all subsequent records are reverse DNS records for my my /48. Now I can go a little deeper. I can say, you can stack the origin keyword in bind. So if you don't end in a dot, actually, anytime you put a record name or use a keyword like this in bind and you don't end in a dot, it's assumed that the record is relative to whatever your last setting of origin was. So I could have written this as origin 2.0.0. blah, 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 all at the top here, all in one line. But by breaking it down, I'm sort of starting to break down how are my delegations doing? So if I'm doing a different /64 network, I could repeat that And I could repeat that, and it would be a little more clear. So got rid of all those other uglies. And I could have added one more zero at the end here. But by doing 1.0 and so on, I'm at least, if I'm doing a whole bunch of static entries, I've only got 16 if I had put this all the way to the end. I would have been able to do 1, 2, 3, down to F, and that would have been it. So chances are, if you're doing a whole bunch of static entries on a network, you know, you might get more than 16 nodes. So you do it that way. It's not.
Why can't you put two like 0, 0, like a byte rather than half a byte rather than a nibble?
It has nothing to do with numbers. Reverse DNS is all about translating characters.
But yeah. Reverse DNS, don't you in the IPv4 put the 256 whole byte in that period?
Yeah, but that's just convention. One of the big problems with that convention with IPv4 reverse DNS is that reverse DNS for anything that isn't on a classical boundary is a royal pain in the butt.
And you're right there.
So by splitting
some
it
delegations
out,
become.
So I mean, they could.
It's easier to delegate this way, basically.
Yeah, we're able to delegate 4 bits at a time.
Which
instead of 8 bits at a time.
Why didn't they just go to straight binary representation? But
yeah. Okay, so let's move on. We're at questions already. Everyone's going to get home tonight. Go for it.
How do the home routers, consumer-grade routers, deal with the IPv4 versus IPv6?
Sort of irrelevant because telecoms aren't offering direct access anyway.
Yeah, because I'm thinking
they won't screw with your tunnel.
I'm just sort of thinking in my case, I've got a home router that I want to serve, like, let's say, my house and the neighbor's houses, but it's not connected to the net. So I want to be a provider on my own.
Oh, then you don't need to do, if you're not connected to the internet, you don't need to do routing. Mm-hmm. All you need to do is switching, and as my crappy little Belkin shows there, it's agnostic to whether I'm carrying IPv6 or IPv4 over it, because it's just carrying Wi-Fi and Ethernet back and forth.
But the deeper answer to that is, in general, they don't. And that is the biggest financial problem to migrating to IPv6, is everybody and their dog basically winds up buying a new home router, or your ISP winds up having to supply you with a new home router. And of course, the ISPs are not exactly.
Can't it be just a firmware upgrade?
But there's so many models, right?
And for many of them, the vendor's just not interested in updating the old. Because some of the CPE devices out there are 10 years old now.
Oh yeah, they're really old.
Yeah.
And like most DSL modems, for example, our experience is that vendors will not provide firmware updates for anything that's more than 12 months old.
Really?
Period. The answer is throw them out, buy a new one. And that's what we're running at. Incidentally, probably the key driver to adoption of IPv6 on the consumer end can be summed up in one word: BitTorrent.
Yeah, it'll be nice to have end-to-end access.
Right. No port forwarding hassles ever again.
Right, but that's assuming that the ISPs get out of their producer-consumer model. Right now, ISPs consider you a consumer; they do not consider you a producer, and that's why more ISPs are getting away with NAT because people aren't producing. Once more people start using video conferencing and anything that requires anything callback related, that's when there'll be pressure to move to something else. Mm-hmm. Until then, we can just NAT till the end of time. Like IPv4 is more than fine, just more the NAT will start floating higher up the stream.
What are the security implications?
Hold on, before I take your question, I just wanted to fill the current discussion. I don't think it'll be a matter of existing sites where end consumers have that sort of ISP choice I talked about. It'll be the kind of thing when ISPs are hooking up new customers, you know, or giving you your cell phones, like, hey, if you could reach the top 100 sites but miss most of the long tail, would that be worth it to you if it saved you $3 a month, $2 a month? And so it'll be, if it happens at all, it'll be at that level with the people who are getting newly connected and are having that chance to have new equipment.
people who are already equipped and connected are probably going to be on V4 a long time.
But eventually new ISPs are not going to be able to get any IPv4 addresses, and they're going to have to come online as IPv6 only.
Well, they can do that either.
Well, there won't be substantial new telecoms anyway.
Sure there will.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wireless.
Well, they'll be selling, they'll be buying and selling enough IPv4 addresses to each other then. And, yeah, there'll be a market for it. And
Ron was saying that's been squelched. You can't.
So far.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
That's going to change.
Okay, you were saying.
So everything's getting a globally addressable address. So your fridge or your house is going to have a globally addressable address. What are the security implications? Like, you're usually protected behind your router. Now they're all getting globally addressed addresses that anything can connect anything directly?
Firewalls.
So everybody there's
a huge difference between firewalling and... I think it's a mistake to use network address translation as a firewalling by default. If you really want firewalling, then you should do actual firewalling, which is distinct from network address translation. It's silly that the two are confused all the time. People get some inadvertent firewalling from using network address translation, but that's not what firewalling is. So, but more, you know, we're living in a world now where it's more likely that your refrigerator might actually come with, you know, an SSL key, and as long as there's not more trouble with that, you know, maybe, you know, if that's the only service it offers and you've got the password and the password's encrypted when you transmit it, who cares if someone else can get to your fridge's login page?
Well, if they do a denial service on my fridge, what's going to happen to my beer?
Well, they can do denial service on you, whether it's your fridge or your cell phone or whatever. Anyway, like it's not having more addresses isn't going to make you more vulnerable to denial of service. You've only got one uplink, you know, and you could say the exact same thing for your router, right?
Actually, so, IPv6 is going to make denial of service attacks harder because the address space is so big. To find the actual address that you need to hit will be harder.
Yeah, a lot of denial of service that happens though isn't random. It's I want to take this guy down, and I know his address.
That's not true. This statement: the bigger address space is going to make it harder to find. The bigger address space is going to make more bots out there that can scan chunks just as fast. I mean, it's all about the proliferation of hosts.
Well, I don't think bots are running out of addresses right now either.
It won't take you longer to scan than it does now.
But hold on here. In a world of there being almost infinite IPv4 addresses by having NAT, those bots will still have the addresses to go out and the bots aren't going to run out of addresses. Because as long as providers start doing IPv4 network address translation, they'll be giving out addresses by the wazoo out of that. So the bots won't have any trouble getting addresses to do sending from. They don't need globally accessible addresses to be reachable at, right? They only need to be able to call home to their master, and call out to whoever they're trying to bring down. So I don't think it matters one way or another about how many addresses are available to bots. Bots will always have addresses that they can use to do what they do.
It's all about who's advertising the routes. You can listen to the routing advertisement. It doesn't matter how big the space is. You know what's there because it's telling you it's there. So that is mostly knowledge. The biggest technical problem right now with rolling out V6 on a global scale is routing. Routers don't have enough memory to have a large set of routes. Like I'm talking between, just say, U.S. and Canada, right? You've got how many /48s? The routing table on those devices has to be in the gigabyte range, not the megabyte range we see now.
Yeah. That is well, I haven't studied
well,
this
not,
too
I'm
much.
I'm not remembering that at all. If you look at it from the perspective of ISPs, right, you're getting such large allocations. A single ISP gets like a /32. Mm-hmm. That gives them 4.2 billion /64s. So yeah. One subnet like per customer of all but the top, the biggest, say 30 ISPs in the entire world. So let's say there's 20,000 ISPs. I'm saying there's 20,000 routes.
No,
with V4, you have a single ISP.
Every hop of the route has to be able to handle all possible routes for every sub-route underneath it. So yeah, you're right. You only have to have 20,000 entries at the top most layer.
But you don't need to list all the subnets.
Well, that's the internet.
You don't have to. You have to be able to accept the advertising.
Yeah.
It actually...
the expansion isn't quite as large as you think it would be, at least, well.
Yeah.
I mean, I've looked at mathematical analyses of it, and I don't remember the math, but, and of course, it depends on your assumptions, right? Mm-hmm. If your initial assumptions are wrong, then your conclusions are wrong. But it looks like it's only going to be about a tenfold increase over what we need today for multiple copies of the global route table. So if you're running an ISP and you've got full feeds coming in from, say, four different peers, you'll need about 10 times as much memory in the IPv6 world, not 1,000 times as much.
Yeah, but still significant.
Oh, yeah, it's still huge. But
memory is cheaper, though, now than it was.
It's installed base. Right? Like, if I want to do NAT and PPPoE and all kinds of fancy stuff, and I have to put a router at every single POP, well, generally speaking, it's the hand-me-down or trickle-down theory, right? My oldest, cheapest routers go the furthest out to the edge where there's the fewest number of customers they have to service. But if those old, cheap routers that are in the IPv4 world would still have another 5 years of life in them are lame ducks when it comes to IPv6, I have to replace them all now before I can go IPv6 across the board. And at today's prices, if I replace that with the cheapest new router I can buy, for the little, like, 6,000 customer network that I'm running, that's about $4 million in routers.
But don't the vendors do firmware upgrades at that level?
The problem is that a lot of the IPv4 forwarding stuff is baked into the hardware.
Okay, so it's hard, hardware. It's harder to...
And, of course, just memory limits, like Sean said. I mean, an old Cisco 2800 series router is only going to have maybe 64 megs of RAM on it. That's not enough.
The further you push it out, the less, the smaller the run deal.
Yeah, but it gets to the point where I have to put that at somebody's house before it's a small enough subnet for it to handle. And at that point, you know, that's a stupid use of that equipment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the financial aspect of it is significant. It depends
okay,
on
so what you're saying is we're not going to be going to V6 in our lifetime. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no, we'll get there, but it'll be on like major ISPs really equipment replacement that. Schedules.
There'd be a lot of IPv6 and V4 translation going on.
Oh, yeah.
You got a last subnet, right?
Yeah, what do you ask?
Yeah, well, isn't he routing the V6 now?
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah, I'll also inquire.
I can speak to that since I actually work there. So we're on the IPv6 internet. We are not doing any production of V6, though. So we don't have any services. We're not distributing that to anybody on our network. The potential problem for our perspective is we can't buy IPv6 trends, at least not yet, in Winnipeg. So everything we do is tunnel here in California, the Hurricane Electric in Fremont. So what I've seen so far is applications, if V6 is available, will choose it. The question then becomes, is an extra 60 milliseconds of latency to do anything, you know, worthwhile? Like, everything hauls to California. That's like my, it's like a point-to-point link to California. On a V6 trace route, you say, I see my router, and then I see California. Yeah. So that's a bit of a holdback, but...
I mean, let's start. It's a start.
Nobody
asks. Yeah.
It's a start. It's like,
and just to clarify this, Les actually kind of reached out to me because he saw I was doing this presentation, and I think the way he put it was, how do you want to tunnel to me and use the tunneling I've got? So it doesn't sound to me like he has, that you can PPP in and get V6 addresses.
I
think that's a Robert thing.
Okay. Isn't there one ISP down in Jasper, Ontario doing V6 video or... Viaphone or starts with a V.
Videotron?
Yeah.
It's Quebec.
Yeah, there's one I think that's doing V6.
Okay. Any other questions about my presentation? The one IPv6 thing I didn't want to cover was like the different kinds of tunneling methods and stuff. That's ugly and failed spectacularly well today. And this is supposed to be one of the most resilient tunneling methods, too, that I was using for getting around crap. And IBM didn't let me go anywhere. I should have used SSH.
The The other thing you got to watch out for on networks, even the current networks, is you've got a bunch of Windows 7 boxes. They will try to tunnel V6 somewhere.
Oh, yeah. To the end, there's an Anycast address reserved for, like, automatically finding a tunnel.
They have three different ways of trying to tunnel, and they'll try all three, and they will actually, I have seen them broadcast routes. So you go into your machine, and you have no IP6 on your network, and you show, and you've got a global address on your machine, and it comes from a Windows 7 box trying to connect over tunneling.
Well, you plug a sniffer into any decent sized network, you'll see quite a lot of IPv6 broadcast traffic going nowhere.
Yeah. No, but is it just link local stuff, or is it the point where computers are automatically finding tunnels and then assigning themselves global addresses?
I've seen global addresses handed out.
Okay. And the tunneling method, now I am talking about tunneling. The tunneling method I suspect in use there is that there's like an IPv4 address that's called an Anycast address that's reserved for, you try and reach that IPv4 address and you'll find the nearest automatic gateway. But some of them are broken. So that's why some people, if you're going to do tunneling, they recommend that you use explicit tunneling where you're explicitly interacting with a tunnel broker instead of one of those automatic ones. So I'll be interested to see the, you know, I was able to ping that Anycast address from my less.net at home, so I'll be interested to see how that automatic. Well, yeah, it's supposed to be routable. It's a matter of whether that address is whether that particular router that I'm reaching is useful. If people are setting them up as like volunteer services and stuff, and then advertising themselves on IPv4 as, hey, I'm the nearest guy who's got this reserved Anycast address.
With respect to DNS, maybe I missed the slide, but what do your PDR records go to?
Oh, PTR?
Yeah, you have the reverse address on one side, PTR, and then the item.
Yeah, well, that item you're referring to would be a quad A record.
Okay, that wasn't mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah. So yeah, quad A records in DNS are the equivalent of A records there. And quad, I think, makes a lot of sense. 32 times 4 is that 128?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why they're quad A. So yeah, if you ever want to here, we'll actually do this exercise here. Okay, I'm going to switch off this network. And on this one. Come on, IBM. Come on, Big Blue. While I'm waiting on this, I'll clean up what I did here. Oh, okay, we're good. Okay, so that one doesn't work. This one works. Sorry? No, I have it at the end.
Story.com is what you want.
There. No, you're getting the...
Oh, you're right. I am quite... Okay. Good. Yeah, you got it right, Adam.
No, you can see the question right there, guys. It's, the question is correct. Yeah. The answer is just not coming.
No, the question is... Okay, it doesn't matter which order you use.
Okay.
Cool. So, here. I know my tunnel broker.
DNS servers.
You know what? This DNS server might be filtering.
Yeah,
filtering. It's quite fun. Oh, but I didn't type this right. There we go. Okay. So there, I queried for some quad A records, and can even do a reverse on these. So yeah, you can query the whole, you can query a lot of IPv6 stuff over IPv4 DNS servers, because it's just quad A is reserved as the record type on DNS, and for reverse, it's reverses are all on .IP6.ARPA instead of
inet.ARPA.
Inet.ARPA, yeah.
Actually, that just reminded me, for a very elegant example of how to do blended V4, V6 bind files, take a look at the default zone files that are installed in FreeBSD's bind package. They've done an excellent job of providing examples in a very elegant, consistent way. So you can have one zone file for both protocols transparently. And it's kind of neat the way they've done it, actually. Works surprisingly well. It takes some time to wrap your head around what the heck is this doing the first time you look at it, and then you realize, oh, like all of a sudden the light bulb goes on and cool. So that's FreeBSD's bind package.
All right, so it's almost 10. I'm going to take other questions in person. Good night.
All right. Thank you. Very much.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more mug meeting summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.